Today's Taisho will be on case 30 in the Pienhu, the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 30 is entitled Joshu's a Big Radish. Main subject: a monk asked Joshu, "I have heard that you closely followed Nansen. Is that true?" Joshu said, "Chinshu produces a big radish." Setchu's verse: "Chinshu produces a big radish. Monks have taken it as their model. They know only how it was and would be. How can they truly realize? The swan is white, the crow black. Plunderer, plunderer. The monk had his nostrils threaded through." So the subject of this koan, the main subject, is a dialogue between Master Joshu, Zhaozhou, and an anonymous monk who asks him a question. So this is probably from the period in Joshu's life when he was wandering around China. At this time, well, let me back up a little bit. Master Joshu, Zhaozhou, was probably one of the two or three greatest Zen masters of the Tang Dynasty. And he was a tremendous inspiration to everybody who knew him. He was legendary in his own time. He lived during the same period of time as Master Linji. So it was quite an amazing period in the history of Zen, of Chan. Master Joshu had his first awakening experience, first dramatic awakening experience, when he was only 17 years old. He was participating in a sesshin and had a great breakthrough. Now, we recently finished our sesshin, and Masae did an amazing job, only 18. I was just astonished. So who knows? Maybe someday she'll be like Master Joshu. I hope so. It's unusual for people who are 17 or 18 to practice Zen. Very unusual, and it would be unusual for even in China for somebody like Joshu to have participated in sesshin and had a great awakening experience. But he did. Sometimes, if you read Tricycle Magazine or some of the yoga journals or some other Vegetarian Times magazines like that, you'll see advertisements for spiritual teachers. And all of these spiritual teachers have programs. They have like a special name for their program. So might be big mind training, or encountering yourself, you know, and so on. And often these people will be interviewed, and they'll talk about their awakening experience. That shows, I think, a healthy interest in many things, But it also has a kind of immaturity to it, you know, because a person like Master Joshu could have had his awakening experience, and he could have said, "Oh, great, I'll start a program called the Joshu Program, and I will go around China and I'll teach people, and I'll have seminars and so on." But he didn't do this. Master Joshu said, "Wow, what was that that just happened to me? What was that?" And so he wasn't content with his kensho, his enlightenment experience. He wanted to plunge more deeply into that beautiful pool. So he asked around and found a teacher whose name was Nan Sen, Nan Chuan. And he became a student of Nan Chuan. And this was an unusual relationship because, you know, sometimes in life you meet people who are interesting. And sometimes you meet people in life who are a little bit more than interesting. You know? There's a kind of energy that it arises. When I first met my teacher Genki Roshi, it was really like something. It spoke to something very deep inside me. You know, I don't think this is in my imagination. You know, I didn't know Genki Roshi at all, but when I met him, it was like I really deeply felt I really deeply felt touched by our relationship. I don't know how else to put it, but it was somehow I knew that this was important, and I don't really have words to describe it, but I just knew it was important, and I wanted to study Zen with Genki Roshi. It was just something I knew that I had to do, and as I continued to study with him, I felt as though my life was getting deeper, was opening up, and that I was somehow becoming, you know, more alive, more alive. I was certainly calmer. I was happier. I had a kind of stability that I hadn't had before, and somehow Genki Roshi allowed that to happen. You know, he was his instruction made it possible for me to break through some barriers in myself. So even now I have a deep love for my teacher, and in Zen this is called karmic compatibility. You know, I've met other teachers in my life, you know, who are very distinguished Buddhist figures, you know, and some of them are much better known, or almost all of them, as a matter of fact, were better known than Genki Roshi. But there was something special about my relationship with Genki Roshi. It just was, you know, it just felt like this is how it has to be. I think Nan Sen and Joshu had that kind of relationship. Sometimes something just clicks, and you know this is opening doors, you know, and you feel alive. I have a friend at work. His name is Richard Miller. And when I first met Richard, you know, we hit it off right away. You know, we had very common interests, you know, and when we work together, it works very well. It just clicks, you know. I've, you know, worked with hundreds of people in my field over the years. I've given papers on panels, and I've done, articles with other people. But when working with Richard is special because something just clicks, you know. And it was the same way with Nansen and Joshu. And they became famous in China. It was like they were always together, and people knew that Nansen was deeply awake, and Joshu was deeply awake, you know. And so they had a reputation as being like ham and eggs, right? Joshu and Nansen. Nansen and Joshu. But Joshu studied with Nansen for quite a long time, something like 45 years. And Nansen, of course, like everybody else, had to die, and he died. And the monks at the temple expected Joshu to take over for Nansen. And Nansen had wanted Joshu to take over because, by any conventional standard, Joshu was deeply a person who had encountered awakened mind many times over and over again. But Joshu decided not to do that. He hit the road. And he went all over China encountering other teachers. I always think about that. You know, that's a really bold thing to do, you know? Because really the only teacher Joshu had ever known was Nansen. And they clicked. They had this special relationship. And it took some nerve, really, having studied with one teacher for 45 years, I might have even been longer, for Joshu to go out and, just encounter other teachers and have his insight tested or evaluated. I have the feeling Joshu didn't go to a monastery and say, "I'm the great Joshu," you know. When I think of him traveling, I think of him just going to a monastery, checking in, going to the visiting monks' quarters, and waiting for Sesshin. And maybe he didn't even use his name Joshu, his Dharma name Joshu. Maybe he made something up, who knows. And he sat down on the cushion and went to Dokusan, and he didn't maybe have any protection. You know, he didn't come in and say, "I'm the great Joshu, I'm a student of Nansen," you know. Maybe he just sat down and let the teacher ask him questions. And I think that takes courage, you know. That takes a kind of willingness to be, it takes a real openness, you know, because he knew that when he was with his teacher Nansen, he could answer koans and encounter reality deeply. But when he met other teachers, maybe it was different. You know, maybe these teachers would find that he wasn't so special. You know, that he didn't know so much. You know, that he hadn't gone so far. You know, actually, this same thing happened to me in a less dramatic way. You know, I trained with Genki Roshi, my first teacher, and for quite a long time. And then I trained with Webb Roshi, my second teacher. And I love both of these people. And Webb and Genki taught together for about 8 years. And so my whole Zen training was with Genki and Webb. And that was my world of Zen. And when I finished my training, I came out to this area, and I flew out to Seattle a couple times to do Sesshin, but You know, I wanted to do a sesshin here with a teacher named Edo Roshi. And I did indeed do sesshin with Edo Roshi. And, you know, Edo Roshi and I wouldn't say have deep karmic compatibility. You know, we just, it wasn't, didn't click. You know, there wasn't that spark or that energy there. I learned a lot from him, however. But it was a little, it made me a little nervous to go to this temple and go into Dokusan for the first time, you know. And to be, you know, on the spot, you know, maybe I didn't know as much as I thought. Maybe I hadn't opened as many doors as I believed, and so on. You know, maybe he would trap me in a koan I couldn't get out of for years and years, you know. And his style is very aggressive, as a matter of fact. So he did indeed insult me, you know, to see what I would do. And belittled my training. You know, now you could say that's really shocking and rude, but he wanted, I guess, to see what kind of person I was, you know. He wanted me to be afraid of losing, you know, what I was holding on to. So even though I don't particularly like that teaching style, it was a good test, right? He was making me afraid, making me hold on to my self-image, you know, and he wanted to see if I could let it go in order to experience something new, that was difficult, you know, it would be easy to go to a place like that and say, I am the Dharma heir of so-and-so, and I've already received transmission, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, like you have your, you know, special place in the Zendo. All of this would be like trying to protect yourself, you know. So indeed, I didn't do that. I just registered for sesshin, and I went to sesshin. And I went into Dokusan, and I just said, you know, I'm so-and-so. I didn't say, I have come from this center, received this and this. Just said, my name is so-and-so, I'd like to do a koan. And then he asked me my story, and I told him my story, and then he insulted me. Which is what a Zen master, a classical Zen master would do, right? Say, huh, I don't know. I can't believe Genki Roshi gave you Dharma transmission. I don't think you have it. So that's, you think, my God, you know, do I have it? So this kind of thing happens in life all the time, right? You know, it's very hard to be challenged, you know? Very hard to be challenged. So this is about a challenge. You know, Joshu is out on the road, and he's going all over China looking for teachers who will challenge him, looking for teachers who can show him something he doesn't already know, you know. And so this is a little bit like being asked to, you know, be knocked on your butt, really, you know. I mean, when you are given a koan, like the Mu Koan, you might have to work for a number of years to get through the koan. And it might be very difficult. You know, it involves a certain amount of a real serious effort to get through the Mu Koan. You have to sit and sit and sit and sit and sit. And then one day, you know, you're finished with the Mu Koan, and you think, this is great, you know, I've finally done it. I finally solved the Mu Koan. And of course, you immediately get another koan. And you might think, well, I solved the Mu Koan, this next koan will be easy. But you know, you're right back where you were again, right? You're trapped in another koan, and you don't know how to get out. And it's, you know, that can be painful, That can be very painful, really, you know. We really want to be able to not, you know, there's a part of us that doesn't like encountering these barriers, you know, these barriers. And we worry that, you know, whatever we have achieved is not really real, you know, it's not really, it's not what we thought it was, you know. So Joshu is a very fearless person, and he says, I'm going to go to these Zen temples, I'm going to introduce myself in a very minimal way, and I'm going to let people ask me questions and see what I know, you know, and people are going to show me things about reality that I didn't understand. And many of the koans in the major koan collection are stories about Joshu going to these various temples and encountering deeply awakened people and people who aren't so deeply awakened. And sometimes people do show him something he didn't see. You know, people do. And he gets a little bit trapped for a while and has to work his way out, you know. And sometimes he just encounters people who don't know anything, and they're just trying to give him a hard time. So in this koan, it looks like it's that kind of a situation. So a monk has heard about Joshu. Joshu's visiting at this temple, and he's heard that the great master Joshu, student of Nansen, is visiting at the temple. And he's thinking maybe, oh, I wonder if this Joshu is everything he's supposed to be. Right? So he comes up and he says, I hear that you were quite the student of Nansen. Right? It's kind of like saying, it's sort of like a challenge. It's like, you know, everybody says, you're cracked up to be quite a great Zen master. I wonder if you are. I wonder if you really are. And Joshu says, Chinshu produces a big radish. Chinshu produces a big radish. You know, coming to, leaving Seattle was very difficult for me. I really became a human being in Seattle, you know. My family life was really very strict. My father was like a very domineering personality. You know, he had this incredibly strong personality, and he was like the dictator of the family. I was telling somebody the other day that when I was in the presence of my father, I felt, maybe you've seen these figures that you can, they're like special balloons. When I was a kid, I had it was like an inflatable figure. He was like a clown. And he had like a little thing, there was a little opening on his toe that you could open up and you could blow air into him and he'd puff up, right? And he'd be like he was this plastic clown, and if you let the air out, he'd deflate down to nothing. You know? And I remember having that as a little kid, this blow-up toy. They probably don't make them anymore, but it was this blow-up clown. And you could blow him up, and then when you were done playing, you could just deflate him. And it was interesting just to blow him up and deflate him. If you're 5 years old, this is fascinating. Mm-hmm. So anyway, when I was in the presence of my father, it would just be like letting all the air out of my body. You know, I would just feel totally crushed by his heavy weight. It was very difficult to be a human being under those circumstances. You know, I wasn't really permitted to be a person. So when I left home and went to the university, I never came home really again. And eventually I went out to Seattle. And my father was so far away now. You know, it was like he was no longer in my life. And for the first time in my life, I could really be a human being. I could really be like my own person, you know. And it was a bit of a risk leaving home, you know. Like, when I went to college, I was very unhappy at home. So going to college was great. But then, you know, when I went out to Seattle, I hitchhiked out to Seattle, actually, you know. And I had never hitchhiked before. And I had read On the Road by Jack Kerouac. And so I thought I would give hitchhiking a try. But it was scary, you know. It was scary to go out. You really can't hitchhike anymore. It's not safe, you know. But it was frightening to, because I had led a very protected life. You know, I'd grown up on military bases, which are actually like sealed off. You know, the school bus would come into the military base and take us to school, and then would take us back to the base, and there's always a guard at the base, you know. And so it's very closed up environment. No matter where you are, you're like in your own little world. And so I lived on the base and I went to school, and that was sort of like my world. And then at home, my father was like the dictator of our family, and I would always have all the air drained out of my body. So I decided not to go home after college, and I hitchhiked across the country. I went out to Seattle. And it was scary for somebody who was like, even though I was like 21 or something, it was frightening. And the frightening part was that, you know, I really didn't want to go home, and I didn't know where I wanted to go, you know. So I just decided on Seattle, and I had lived there earlier in my life, you know, so, or near there. We lived in a place called Bremerton, Washington, which is maybe 50 miles from Seattle. And I had gone to school there at one point. But again, I'd lived on a military base, you know. So I decided to hitchhike out to Seattle, and it was frightening. And I hope you won't think less of me, but, you know, when I was sleeping in a tent, you know, I had a tent that I'd used for backpacking. And I can remember actually like crying in my tent, you know, because it was just very nerve-wracking. I'd never done anything like this before. And I was pretty young, you know, and I remember crying. I was scared, you know. There wasn't anything in particular to be scared of. But I got to Seattle, and I was living right in the city, you know. And it was exciting. It was frightening and exciting. And then later on, I met Genki Roshi, and that took nerve to do that, and it was frightening. And then eventually I lived in Seattle, and my wife and I really liked Seattle, and I loved the Zen Center. And coming out here was really scary again, you know. And coming to Rutgers was very hard for me, because I really wound up loving Seattle. And I had all my friends in Seattle, and also coming to Rutgers was scary, because you know, I had to publish books and articles, and it was very competitive, you know, very competitive. So it's hard to do this, you know. Maybe it's easier for you than it was for me, but it was hard for me to like cross those bridges. You know, across those bridges. It's like you come to a point where you have to walk across a bridge to the next thing, you know? And it's scary. It's frightening sometimes. And you know, we get used to where we are and who we are, and we get accomplished with the life we have. And then, you know, you have to cross this bridge into like the unknown. And it's frightening, right? But Joshu was not afraid to do that over and over again. And I think that's what made him such a interesting person, such an unusual and inspiring person. you know, you do meet people like this in life who are, you know, they must be scared of a challenge, of being knocked down or defeated. You know, when I came to Rutgers, I was so afraid I was going to get fired, you know, basically, not get tenure and be sent away, you know, a big failure. And I would write these articles and I send them off and they would get rejected and I would get very frightened about this. So I guess, you know, everybody goes through this in life. My life has been pretty safe, had a pretty easy life. But for me, you know, hitchhiking across the country the first time was really scary. Going to graduate school was scary, you know, because I was a very good undergraduate, and then I went to graduate school, and I wasn't a very good graduate student all of a sudden. And it was frightening. And then leaving Seattle was frightening, and so on and so on. But, you know, I think Zen is all about working with these transitions, you know. Or a lot of Zen is about working with these transitions, you know, crossing these bridges with the right attitude, you know. If you do very little in your life, if you know, you might not have to cross too many bridges. But if you are curious, if you are creative, if you are, you know, adventurous, whatever, you're going to have to cross bridges, you know, over and over again, where there's this, where you feel like you're on the line, or you feel exposed or vulnerable, and you might feel inadequate to the task, and so on and so on. And indeed, sometimes we really do fail, you know, that's just a fact. I mean, sometimes Joshu met teachers who really probably trapped him in koans that he couldn't get out of. And, you know, he might have thought, well, I thought I had a deep understanding, but I see now that I don't, you know. So I think a lot of Zen practice is learning how to be comfortable with these, being in these transition, these transitions. Where we're moving from one safe place to an unknown place, and you know, Zen is very much about this. You know, it's, in my opinion. So you know, when you solve your first koan, it's a great moment, really, especially the mu koan, because breaking into mu shin is so crucial for all your practice after that. But you know, you get another koan and you're right back there again, you know, and some people who have been doing Zen for 10 or 12 years, you know, you would think it gets easier, but actually it would be a great misfortune if it became too easy. You know, the whole point of the koan is to show you something new or something, or open a new door, you know, and that always involves the fear of failure, you know, uncertainty, that unpleasant feeling of being trapped or being, you know, undermined or knocked on your butt, you know. And yet, you know, most people want to run from that experience, but I think Zen is about seeing how important that kind of experience really is, you know, how important it is. You know, my mother, I said a little earlier that my father was like the dictator of my family. My mother was an interesting person, you know, because when she was young, she was a very creative, adventurous person. My mother loved skiing. She taught herself to ski. She lived in a part of upstate New York that was very poor. And her father didn't encourage her to be, you know, anything special. Just he wanted her to just be quiet, basically. And my mother was interested in life and very adventurous, and she taught herself how to ski. She, She used to ski up at Whiteface Mountain. And she became a really good skier, downhill skier. And she liked to ride horses, and she was very interested in archery. And she wasn't encouraged to be, you know, get an education or be professional. But my mother finished high school, which, believe it or not, at that time was in that part of the country, was an accomplishment for a woman to finish school. She finished high school and she took her New York State Regents exam and did very well. And if you know, in another time, I think my mother might have become a lawyer, you know, because she loved the law. But she went to work in a law office, and eventually she became a court clerk. She was a stenographer and so on. But when she married my father, it wasn't so good for her, you know, because my father had this very dominant, crushing personality. And little by little, my mother got to be more and more closed up, and less of the person she used to be. And so, you know, when my parents got divorced, it was really hard for my mother. You know, she really sort of like cracked up. But the interesting, you know, she really didn't take it well. You know, my father had deceived her and had an affair. And my mother, that really hurt her self-esteem, you know. And she really sort of fell apart for a while. But, you know, gradually she came out of it, and she got a job and did very well at their job. And little by little, she sort of like started opening doors again in her life. And she became like an administrative secretary to a person in the Virginia state government. You know, she was very efficient, good memory, and so on. She could, you know, type an amazing number of words a minute, and good file, you know, good, very good at organizing information. So even though it was very painful, you know, it was the best thing. Getting out of my father's clutches, you know, was really like the best thing that ever happened to my mother. And I'm sorry she didn't have more tools for going through this transition, but I really think Zen is about, it gives you the tools. You know, this is, anybody who's going to live life, I think, deeply, is going to be crossing these bridges, you know, from what you know to what you don't know. And it's so nerve-wracking and frightening, you know, it's frightening. But sometimes, if we handle it right, it can be this tremendous opportunity to have a deeper life, you know, if we handle it right. And so I think what Zen does is show you, you know, lets you sit in sometimes in an unpleasant place, you know, with your fear, with your sense of worthlessness, you know, facing the fact that you can't control the situation, you know. And you sit there with that, and it's very unpleasant. You know, I don't want to discourage you if you're just getting started in Zen. You know, koans aren't that bad. But, you know, if you take them seriously, it can be very frustrating, you know. And it's just like, you know, it's like, it's a little bit like crossing these bridges we have to cross in our lives, you know, where you're, you know, you're just not sure, you might just drop right off the edge, you know. But what happens when you're in that situation is that you can find, if you do this long enough, you stay there long enough, you find there's like an alternative consciousness. You know, you have a kind of mind that is very self-centered, and it's like, how can I protect myself? I need to protect myself. I'm so afraid. You know, what if I fail? You know, and so on. And of course, this is also the mind that has big dreams. And so, but if I succeed, you know, I'll finally be real. You know, I'll finally be special, I'll finally be worthy of love, or whatever. You know. But that's the normal, like, small mind, we said. That's your small mind. if this happens, finally I'll be worthy of love, worthy of respect. You know? If it doesn't happen, it's like dying. You know, I might as well just be dead. Maybe I'll kill myself. But there's this other mind, you know, and it's a big mind. You know, you're sitting on the cushion and you're worried and you're fearful, and then all of a sudden your mind just becomes serene. You know, and it's not that you came up with some new idea. See, Zen practice isn't like getting a new idea. It's just like a switch goes on in your head and you enter a different state of consciousness. So there's no concept here that triggers this change, right? I mean, if you're frightened and you're worried and you're in a transitional period, somebody can say anything to you and you can know intellectually that it might or might not be true, but it doesn't really change anything. Ideas don't have any real power when you're really in an extreme situation. You know it's just BS, right? But if you just sit in your fear, or sit with your fear, and you do your Zen, you know, you straighten the back, you breathe through the Dantian, you watch the breath, you enter Wuxin, you know, sooner or later, it's like a switch is going to go on in your head, and you're going to have this serene mind. It's like no problems. There's no obstacle anywhere. And I'm not making this up. If this hasn't happened to you, it will happen to you. You know, it's all of a sudden like this water has been agitated, choppy. All of a sudden, it just becomes like calm. And the results no longer matter. The results are not important. It's just being present here, you know. And it's not a, you know, my telling you that doesn't make, you know, you can't come away from my Taisho today saying, now I understand, you know. Because there's nothing it has to happen to you. It's like a switch going on. But if you practice Zen, I promise you it will happen over and over again. You know. And you sit down on the cushion, and you're terrified, and your mind thinks, but what if this happens? What if this happens, right? We all do this. We think, oh my God, and what if that happens? Oh, that's the world, oh my God. I know, you know, okay. That, we all have a part of ourselves that's like this, right? You think of the worst case, and then you realize there's an even worse case, you know, and an even worse, you know. But there's another mind that you will find if you sit on the cushion, where all of a sudden it all becomes serene. And when you're working with your koan, you know, basically what happens at some point when you're working with a koan is you just don't care anymore. And you enter this serene place where you're just being present with the koan. You know? And usually at that time, something arises, you know. It just pops something, you become aware of something, or something pops into your head, you know, and often that's the solution to the problem. What happens when you cross these bridges is that your world gets bigger and bigger, you know, nobody likes defeat, nobody likes an obstacle. You know, nobody likes being thrown down. Nobody likes, whatever. Whatever you're afraid of, just you pick your fear. But Zen is about coming up to these obstacles, you know, and working through them, or crossing the bridge with a serene mind. And sometimes it can take a lot of sitting. You know, you sit and sit and sit and sit, and you're still like agitated, fearful. But I don't think anything can be accomplished when you're in that state. I mean, you sometimes have to work in that state. You sometimes have to, but that's not like the best state. you know, at some point you will enter this state where your mind is serene and everything seems to open up in front of you, right? And the outcome doesn't matter. And that's, I think, the optimal state for living life, you know? And if you go through this process again and again, I think it is possible to become like very happy person, very open, very creative person, you know? This is really what Zen is all about. You know, we're so afraid of the next door, you know, but we don't always open them. You know, some people really don't want to open those doors because it could be so costly or painful, you know. But you know, we all have it. But if you do open them, and it's usually very hard, but if you do open them, the world gets bigger, not smaller, you know. You know, my mother didn't really want to get divorced, even though she was, my mother was so unhappy living with my father, but it was the world she knew, right? And so it was better to stay with what you knew because the next door could be even worse, right? So she got sort of pushed through the door by life, but going through was the best thing that ever happened to her. And, you know, I've been through that kind of experience myself, you know, where I didn't want to didn't want change that was coming to happen, you know, sort of resisted this change. But then, as it was happening to me, you know, my Zen practice really helped me to enter that state where I began to see this is a wonderful thing, you know, wonderful thing. When I got my PhD, there weren't a lot of jobs in my field. You know, I went to school for something like 7 years, I had expected to get a job, but there were so few jobs when I got my PhD. I would go. Apply, write all these letters, and get all these rejections. And was thinking, of course, you know, what's going to happen to me? You know, I'm going to be, you know, digging ditches. I'll be on the street. You know, I'll be, you know, fantasies of the worst that could happen. And I went for a job interview with a company called TRW. And they were going to pay like a fantastic amount of money. They wanted people who would be technical writer and advertising person. And so I got a job interview. And I didn't get the interview. I was very competitive. And when I didn't get the interview, I was really, I felt really let down. You know, like this was a major calamity. And my wife actually cried when I came back from the interview because it was like, you know, this beautiful life was right ahead of us, right? You know, like, just a beautiful life. And when I didn't get the interview, it was like personally, like very humiliating to me. It felt very difficult to deal with. And my wife was just weeping because, you know, we were going to be stuck in our crummy little apartment. And anyway, you know, I sat down on the cushion and had such a beautiful sit, you know. It was like my whole body hurt, but I had this beautiful sit. It was just, I've never forgotten it. It was one of the best sits in my life, really and truly. And you know, so we just went on with our lives, and you know, it was the best thing in the world. I didn't get that job, really. I mean, I realize now that I would have been so unhappy in that job. You know, that, I mean, really. And then I got this job at Rutgers, which has turned out to be, you know, the best thing in the world for me. You know? So you just... So... Zen is about, use Zen to deal with, to cross your bridges, yeah? And every time you do cross them, you know, life gets bigger, bigger and bigger and bigger. And as I say, what you need to find is that place, that mind that's serene. Right? This is the best way to act in the world, is from that serene place. It's not always possible, but there's a state of mind you can find if you practice long enough, which is like imperturbable. Imperturbable. It's like you can handle anything, right? This is like, some of you may have seen statues of Avalokiteshvara with a thousand arms, right? And this is Guanyin, sometimes represented with a thousand arms. And these are all arms that can help people, right? So the thousand arms are all the different ways you can be helpful to other people. And you know, you become that kind of a person by going through this process over and over again. You know, coming up to a barrier, crossing a bridge, and entering a bigger self, finding that serene mind. And then there's really like nothing you, at some point you're just not so afraid. You know, I'm not going to say there's nothing you're afraid of. There's always something you're going to be a little afraid of. But you cross this bridge and this bridge and this bridge and this bridge, life is a lot less frightening, a lot more inviting, a lot more beautiful, a lot more exciting. A monk asked Joshu, "I've heard you closely followed Nan Sen, is that true?" Joshu said, "Chinshu produces like a big radish. Oh, it's always a big radish. Huh? Life is a beautiful big radish. I'm so afraid, but there's a way to encounter this big radish. Can you find that mind yourself? Please find that mind. If you can find that mind, next time you face a challenge, there's nothing you can't do." Secho's verse. Chinshu produces a big radish. Monks have taken it as their model. This is the way of Zen, facing these challenges, crossing these bridges. They know only how it was and would be. How can they truly realize the swan is white, the crow is black? Everything is going to happen the way it's going to happen. This is marvelous unfolding. You know, you can be part of the process, or you will be part of the process. You can be terrified, you can be happy, you can be excited, you can be full of joy. It's how you respond. And then plunderer, he's insulting Joshu, because of course Joshu gave such a good answer. So the monk had his nostrils threaded through. This is like people put a rope through the nose of a bull. Basically, Joshu is leading this monk to a deeper mind, leading him to big radish. Please find that place in yourself, and there's nothing you can't deal with.